So, this forum is to speak about the NHS in crisis. Thank you everyone for coming along. I mean that from the bottom of my heart. I work in the NHS and I represent the Royal College of Midwives on Chesterfield Trades Council. I've been a midwife in the area for 21 years and I've seen up front years and years of cuts by austerity, not only to my wages but to services. And as midwives we want to provide an excellent standard of care, and that's sometimes impacted on by the cuts that we face. So we're very lucky, we have two excellent speakers here tonight to talk to you about local issues and national issues that are occurring. We've got Dr. Colin Hutchinson, who is representing doctors for the NHS, and we also have Maurice Neville here next to me, who is representing Derbyshire Save Our NHS. So we'll move on to our first speaker, who's Colin Hutchinson from Doctors for the NHS.
Good evening, thank you very much. My name's Colin Hutchinson. I've worked in the NHS since 1973. I was a consultant eye surgeon in Halifax and Huddersfield and previously in Aberdeen. I retired in 2015. For 10 years I was a clinical director of head and neck services in the trust that I worked in. So my job, apart from running a clinical caseload, was also trying to stop the wheels falling off the eye department, the ear, nose and throat department, and maxillofacial departments. And it was getting harder and harder to keep the service together. It's like a sort of duck going across a fast flowing stream. You know, you might keep going, but you don't see how fast the little legs are going underneath the water. So when I retired in 2 years ago, I've gradually become increasingly more involved. Well, I had time to actually try and find out why things were getting more and more difficult and get my head around the changes that were going on in the NHS, because there's really nowhere that you can go to find the whole picture. There's nowhere that it's all set out what direction things are going, how they're going in that direction, what the knock-on impacts of that will be. As a result of that, I've become involved in campaigning against the changes to our local health service in the part of West Yorkshire that I live in Halifax and Huddersfield. And then more recently, I've become involved at a national level, not only as chair of Doctors for the NHS, which was set up in 1976 as the NHS Consultants Association, but has changed over recent years to include all doctors, or be open to all doctors who feel that the NHS should be run as a public service, not as a profit-making organisation. And I've also become involved in taking legal action against Jeremy Hunt and NHS England about their plans to introduce a model of care that was derived from America called Accountable Care Organisations. And so we've been granted a judicial review at the Royal Courts of Justice in May to look at whether what they're doing is actually legal or not. The NHS is going to turn 70 on the 5th of July. It's become part of the British way of life, one of the things that gives us a national identity and that we can all be proud of. The NHS has got to that position because it's such a simple concept that almost the whole nation can get behind. Accidents and disease can strike any of us at any time in our lives. We can't eliminate that risk, but if we all chip in for a fair tax system to help each other out, we can try and make sure that everybody has access to help when disaster strikes. It's a simple idea. It's also a simple and cheap system to administer. Unless, that is, you're unable to understand how you can have such a level of state expenditure without somebody making a profit from it. Once that idea gains traction, it turns a simple system into an administrative monster. Mm-hmm. and that monster needs feeding with ever greater amounts of taxpayers' money, more and more of which goes to middlemen and company profits, not to frontline services. That's the path that we've been heading along for the past 30 years. That's what we've done with the most cost-effective and the most humane health system in the world. Because the NHS has become such an integral part of being British, we've become complacent. Surely no government would be daft enough to get rid of it. Now, they'll always keep something that they can call the NHS. It's going to be a small, shriveled remnant of a safety net. If you doubt me, look at what's happened to NHS dentistry, if you want to see what the future's going to be like. The government doesn't even make any pretense at fully funding dental needs for the country. Only 56% of the cost of NHS dentistry is actually funded. It allows a basic basket of treatments, and anything else you need to either pay for yourself or take out insurance policies to cover that sort of payment. And it's not cost effective. So many people, the lack of any preventative dental treatment means that people are pitching up at accident emergency or their GP with dental infections, toothache. Chances are that they will get some form of treatment, but they'll still have to go and see a dentist anyway to get it properly sorted. And treatment for dental abscesses and removing rotting teeth is the commonest cause for needing a general anaesthetic in children these days. So we're racking up costs that could be managed by an appropriate NHS dental service, but it isn't there. Things are going seriously wrong in the UK. The past 150 years, there's been a year-on-year increase in life expectancy for people. That came to a halt in 2011, when life expectancy plateaued off, and for some people, it's beginning to fall now. And the death rates around the time of birth and in the first year of life are increasing now. And we're getting more and more out of kilter compared to other countries that we would compare ourselves with. These are signs that not all is well in society, not just in the healthcare system. This particularly affecting children from poorer households, and to our shame, childhood poverty is also increasing. In 2010, we had a health service that was riding high in public approval, with the shortest waiting times for treatment that I can remember in my working life. What's happened since then? Well, we've had 8 years of austerity policies since then. In 2010, the decision was made to cut. The government can still claim that they're funding the NHS at record levels, because each year, for the last 8 years, the amount of money that's been given to the NHS has been going up by 1% per year. But the average for the whole of the lifetime of the NHS has been to go up by 4% per year. So the amount that it's being funded is falling far below what is needed to keep pace with the increasing population that we have. In 2010, the decision was made to cut nurse training places by 14%. Now, that doesn't have an effect immediately, but year on year, the impact increases. Add to that the fact that the real value of wages has decreased in nursing, the removal of the nurse training bursary, and particularly that nursing staff are being asked to do so many impossible things each day that people feel they just can't cope with providing a level of care that they know is not adequate, and so people vote with their feet and leave. Mm-hmm. With a similar cuts, not to the same extent, to the numbers of medical student places as well, that have also fed through to serious staffing problems, particularly in specialties like accident and emergency, paediatrics, psychiatry. These are all suffering from lack of staff. And that's most of the problem in areas that aren't actually central hospitals. So in my area in Halifax and Huddersfield, in my department, for 8 years we've not been able to get a glaucoma specialist for the eye department. For five years I led the skin cancer team. Now that's normally a dermatologist that leads a skin cancer team, not an eye surgeon with an interest in skin cancer. But there's more than 100 vacant dermatology consultant posts around the country. They just aren't out there to recruit. Now, what they say is, well, we haven't got enough doctors, we haven't got enough nurses, so we need to make the hospitals smaller. And that is a decision that Sir Humphrey would be really proud of. But we don't have the numbers of hospital beds. We've got a third of the number of hospital beds per head of population that they have in France and Germany. In Halifax and Huddersfield, they want to demolish Huddersfield Royal Infirmary. And that will reduce the number of hospital beds to 1.4 per thousand, which is fewer than they have in Mexico and Colombia. That is not the league that we ought to be comparing ourselves with. So, as usual within the NHS, they say, "Well, you know, things are getting tough. What we need is a reorganisation. Move the deck chairs around. Don't worry about those icebergs. What we need is new models of care. So rather than saying, well, times of austerity, we hunker down and we focus our resources on the front line. Protect the front line, make sure that works, because that's the bit that really affects the patients. They tell us, no, diseases and people have changed over the last 70 years. Well, to the best of my remembrance, we had chronic diseases 70 years ago. We had tuberculosis, we had rheumatic fever, we had severe lung disease. Those were all around at that time. So chronic diseases are nothing new. And people aren't really that much different now from how they were 70 years ago. They say care at home is cheap, but it's cheaper to look after people at home than it is in hospital. There is absolutely no proof of that at all. My wife's a district nurse. A district nurse can, in hospital, a nurse can supervise 6, 7, maybe 8 patients at a time. If you're looking after people in their own homes, you can only look after the person that's in front of you at that time. And you don't have the backup of people easily to hand that you can call on to ask advice from or to give you a hand. Plus you have the travel time to go around from person to person. So there is no evidence, that's not just a feeling, there is actually no evidence that it is cheaper to look after people at home, because you lose the economies of scale. The National Audit Office has also found that we're told that we've got to bring health and social care together. Well, it all used to be together up till the 1980s, but it was separated off in the towards the end of Dear Margaret's reign, and you know, it would be a good idea to bring it back together. But the National Audit Office found that no evidence that integration reduced the cost or reduced the level of need for acute hospitals. for the last couple of years, there's been what have been called vanguard projects going on around the country, where they've tried various of these new models of care. And some of them have worked, seem to have worked quite well, but it's like when you're trialing out medical treatments. If you've got people who are enthusiastic and really have a lot of drive, then they can get results that are different from when it's rolled out to the generality. And the Vanguard dashboard figures, which were released earlier on this year, found that in areas where there was a Vanguard, there may have been a slight reduction in the increase in emergency admissions, the hospitals where there was a Vanguard. Though it was still higher than in the non-Vanguard areas. But it had made no difference to the number of days that people spent in hospital beds. So the results are not, they don't blow you away really, and they wouldn't be enough for me to say that there should be a wholesale reorganisation of health services across England. But it's being done, this reorganisation is being done in a very underhand way. It's being done in small steps, incrementally. Little changes here, little changes there. Nothing big enough to say that it needs a public consultation. And nowhere are they saying, this is where we're going to end up, this is what the benefit will be, this is what it's going to look like to you. You know, they're feeling their way and trusting that people don't really notice too much and kick up too much of a fuss. Now, in September 2017, Department of Health decided to hold a consultation exercise on the introduction of a contract for what are called accountable care organisations. And that set various alarm bells ringing. Accountable care organisations are a concept that was developed in the United States and was developed further following the 2012 World Economic Forum in Davos, where they decided that around the world it would be better if there was people were looked after in a different sort of way. And they, together with McKinsey, one of the big four accountancy firms, Simon Stevens, who is now head of the NHS in England, but at that time was vice president of United Health, one of the biggest health insurance companies in the world. I mean, their assets are way far, far bigger than the entire assets of Barclays Bank. It's a big organisation. He was their vice president with a special responsibility for positioning the organisation to take advantage of changes in legislation in health around the world. In 2014, Jeremy Hunt invited him over to take control of the NHS in England. It's an interesting character. He started off as a Labour councillor in Brixton, was taken to Tony Blair's Prime Ministerial Number 10 Delivery Unit. That's not to deliver babies, it's to deliver the changes that they wanted to bring into place. And then in about, he was the main architect of the NHS plan in 2006, which introduced foundation trusts and a lot of the other pro-market detritus that we're coping with now. So accountable care organisations, what are they? Well, they can be what you want them to be, really. We're told there's lots and lots of different models, and everywhere we'll have a different model, which cunningly means they don't actually have to describe what an English accountable care organisation might be. But basically, it's where a single organisation is given a 10 to 15 year contract, usually worth many billions of pounds, to take most decisions on the provision of health and social care for the population under its that it serves. It may not actually have to deliver any of those services itself. It can outsource them all along the sort of Carillion type model, if it wants to. It could, an accountable care organisation may include hospital trusts, GPs, but it can just, there's no reason, nothing to stop it also including property companies, finance companies, insurance companies. And an accountable care organisation is given a fixed amount of money, depending on how many people it's looking after at the beginning of the year. And any money it doesn't spend on looking after people, it can keep as a profit and share it out amongst the partners in this special purpose vehicle. And you can see how there is then an incentive to
save money.
Well, I mean, it could be an incentive to make sure that the population you're looking after is getting healthier and healthier and healthier by having good smoking cessation clinics, encouraging people to be more active, drink less, eat less, have less sugar. That might help reduce the demand, or they'd also have to have warm, dry housing, good quality, stable jobs that keep them fulfilled. there's a few other things that might help their general level. Alternatively, they could employ staff at cutback rates, with less experience and lower grades. That would help reduce their costs. Or they could cut back the range of treatments that they offer to people. So the less treatment you give, by say rationing hip replacements, knee replacements, cataract operations, I think that's something that's going on at the moment, certainly in my area and in many others too. There's procedures of limited clinical value. They're very keen on procedures of limited clinical value and saying, well, we won't provide those either. So the less treatment that you actually give, the more likelihood that there is that you'll have some surplus over at the end of the year. They're also being proposed to be able to dissolve the boundaries between health and social care, which sounds wonderful. It means that you won't have different organisations being involved in different aspects of looking after your care, until you realise that health is supposed to be a comprehensive, universally available service that's free at the point of delivery, and social care is rationed. It's means tested, and it's the system has a lot of co-payments and charges actually built into it. Now, it's quite possible that the government may mean that they're going to make social care free at the point of as it is in Scotland. Somehow, I doubt it. And so, the accountable care organisation will be able to define what is health and what is social care. And when you think of things like intermediate care beds, so that when people have been moved out of the main hospital into a convalescent unit, is that going to be defined as health or is it social care? If somebody's having a therapist visiting them at home, may that be defined as health and social care? If you're in hospital, the laundry, the food that you're having, the air that you're breathing, they have debated hotel charges for your stay in hospital. Now that may not occur, but there's nothing in the rules that they've been drawing up that would necessarily rule it out. And these accountable care organisations are not mentioned in any Act of Parliament. They've not been defined, their boundaries haven't been set out, debated and voted on in Parliament. They would be non-statutory bodies. They wouldn't be governed by statute, they'd be governed by commercial law, by contract law, which means that it's doubtful whether they'd be accessible to freedom of information requests or open to challenge through judicial reviews. So a lot of people got rather worried with this consultation, and I've joined with four other people, the late Stephen Hawking, Professor Alison Pollock, who's a professor in public health at the University of Newcastle, Dr. Graham Wynyard, who's a retired director of the NHS in England, and Professor Sue Richards, who's vice chair of Keep Our NHS Public and a professor in public administration at the University of Birmingham. And we set in motion, we took action to try and ask for a judicial review into what NHS England was doing, because we felt that for these changes to be brought through without them being debated and voted on in Parliament and set up with clarity under statute, that it would all end in tears. In a judicial review, the courts aren't able to pass judgment on government policy. There's this separation between the judiciary, the courts, and the legislature, the government. And they're very careful to not tread on each other's toes. So the courts can't challenge, say, well, whether accountable care organisations are a good thing or a bad thing. They can only determine whether they're acting within they're being set up within the law. So we decided to go through the judicial review because there was no chance of actually getting anything done through political lobbying. And two judicial reviews have taken place. One is for a group called 999 called the NHS, who are a group of activists, and they're challenging this idea of the payment being through what's called capitated budgets, so that the amount of money that an accountable care organisation gets depends on the number of people that it's looking after. And no matter whether they're particularly ill, what happens to them, that's all that they get. And they've been granted a judicial review in Leeds on the 24th of April. And I'm with a group called JR4NHS. We're challenging both NHS England and Jeremy Hunt on the grounds that the powers that they're planning to give to the accountable care organisations are laid out by law to be the powers of the clinical commissioning groups and NHS England, and they haven't, and it would be illegal for them to delegate those powers to anyone else. We're also, and you know, it's the solicitors that are acting on behalf of NHS England. So it's whether they can be commissioners as well as providers of service. And it's that commissioners that would be illegal in our view. And if you look at the website of DAC Beechcroft, who are the solicitors that advise NHS England, they also say to be truly effective, accountable care organisations would have to be commissioners as well as providers. So their solicitors seem to agree with us, which is quite nice that we've got that. We're also challenging them on lack of transparency, that there's a common law duty to publicly make clear their proposals to reorganise the NHS in England in this way. to explain why accountable care organisations are necessary, what the risks and the benefits might be, and the implications of switching funding to this model. We had also challenged them on their lack of consultation, that they were planning to actually bring in these contracts for use before there had been any public consultation on them, and that there'd be no legal, public or parliamentary scrutiny of these plans. Now, since we brought that this action, there's been a couple of government U-turns. They decided that they wouldn't introduce, let these contracts be used until after there's been a public consultation. And they also asked the Health Select Committee in the Commons to carry out an inquiry into accountable care organisations as well. So we've dropped those two grounds because they've done what we, in part, what we were asking them to do. But we're pushing ahead with the other two grounds. We funded it through a crowdfunding procedure which raised £280,000, which was enough to actually cover the costs of the legal teams, because we had to bear in mind we might lose, and paying two lots of expensive legal teams costs would be quite expensive, and so that's going ahead, and it's been quite an interesting experience being involved. Trying to actually get the publicity going. And when we started off, nobody really had heard, very few people had heard of accountable care organisations. Probably quite a lot of people still haven't heard of accountable care organisations. But I mean, I've had interviews on Sky TV, LBC, ITV. We've spoken in the House of Commons and in the various public meetings like this, and in December, Stephen, Professor Hawking joining us as one of the claimants. Mm-hmm. That helped gain a much wider exposure to the case. So the fact that we've managed to obtain some reversals or some U-turns in the government's sort of gung-ho bringing through these policies has been quite gratifying. And we need to see what happens in May. The Health Select Committee inquiry, the lack of transparency is shown by the fact that inquiry was set up last year. It's gone through three changes of name in the time since it was set up. It was started off being set up into Sustainability and Transformation Partnerships and Accountable Care Systems. They then added in, once we'd started our challenge, to add in accountable care organisations as well. And now NHS England have decided, oh, accountable care organisations seem to be too toxic a title. We'll call them integrated care systems and integrated care partnerships. So they added those into the title of this inquiry. Three out of the four of us went and gave evidence to the inquiry, and I must admit it wasn't really a meeting of minds. The things that they paint us up as being totally against any form of collaborative working, which is not the case. I mean, I can remember back in the 1980s where we had district health authorities and they were public bodies that did what accountable care organisations are supposed to do, but they were done within the public services. mm-hmm. and they worked very well. Mm-hmm. We were particularly criticised for saying that this, you know, that paging it as a form of American model of healthcare, but accountable care organisations, as described, are an American care of health, a model of healthcare. You don't say we're going to look after everybody in a particularly geographic area. It's people who are actually enrolled members of the accountable care organisation who are able to have care, be treated. So you have to be taken on as a member of the accountable care organisation to receive treatment. And they can decide whether or not to take you on, depending on the risks that they feel that you might pose. They can make a profit from denying people treatment, and there are a number of other sort of measures that like that. We were also criticised for scaring people that they might have to start paying for their care. But with the abandonment of the 18-week referral to treatment time targets, waiting times have got longer and longer. The fact that NHS England decided to stop all planned operations for a couple of months over winter, extending waiting times even further. The fact that they're increasing their being more and more stringent about the criteria to offer people treatment like joint replacements, like cataract surgery, means that that people won't necessarily be able to get as easy access to treatment to keep them working, driving, leading a pain-free, full life, you know, the things that make a difference to the quality of life. So they're going to be more likely to dip into their own pockets or somebody else's to pay for such treatment. And in fact, in my own hospital, it's part of the, since 2013, hospitals are able to make up to 50% of their income, but through privately paying patients, either through insurance or self-paying patients. And my own hospital has in their financial plan, it actually says that they're looking to increase their funding through privately paying patients because of increasing national and regional waiting times and increasing thresholds for treatment. So, you know, I don't think it is scaremongering to say that, yeah. that more and more care will need to be paid for by yourself, and that's whether we have accountable care organisations or not. So we'll see what. So the 999 judicial review is taking place on the 23rd of April in Leeds, and our one's the 23rd and 24th of May, and we'll see where we are from that. But the march of integrated care continues, whatever happens with these reviews, and I think it's up to us all to try and engage with the political process as much as possible to try and get our elected representatives to throw out this form of increasing commercialisation of the NHS. Otherwise we really are going to end up with an NHS that's for the few, not for the many.
Thank you very much, Colin. That was amazing. And like we said at the beginning, we said it's talking about the NHS. It goes on and on. Right, so it's now my pleasure to introduce Maurice Neville to the forum, and he's going to talk from
Derbyshire Save Our NHS. Thank you. I've got two main interests in this topic about the NHS. One is I'm a member of the a Belplat branch originally of SOS NHS, which was formed about 5 years ago. And it has joined up with and helped in, to found in some cases other groups around the county. We now have a county structure. And we were created largely because of the 2012 Health and Social Care Act, and also because of the way that, certainly locally to us, Labour Party members were starting to get very much engaged with worries about the future of the NHS. And so that is typically the case that most of the activists in the campaign are Labour Party members. Secondly, I'm with the Borough Councillor in Amber Valley, and I'm on the Scrutiny Committee. And one of the tasks of the Scrutiny Committee has been to look at the contribution of the Borough Council to tackling health inequality. And in 2013, the officers and members put together a working group which looked at, well, what are the problems in this borough? How do we as a Borough Council work with partners in the NHS, with all the County Council or other organisations to reduce health inequality? And by that I mean a 10-year gap in life expectancy for men between the richest and poorest parts of the borough, and for women I think it's more like 6 years, but it's the same gap. And the really shocking thing, because I was pushing for us to review this, and we were due to review it last year, was that no officer was able to spare the time to do so because of the cuts. So I volunteered to do it, and what I discovered was, if you look at the public health statistics, there has been no improvement whatsoever in the health inequality gap between 2013 and 2015. As we've heard already, people are actually dying younger, and the gap for women in Thames Valley has actually got worse. So the poorer parts of the borough, you're even more likely to die younger than you were 5 years ago. So we're going backwards, and that's a real shock. And so that's my motivation. There is a huge amount of detail about what's happening. It's very hard to grasp, and it's very hard to keep track of, because as we've heard, it's changing all the time. In the course of the period since 2016, when we first heard about the Derbyshire Sustainability and Transformation Plan, Slash Trash and Plunder, as we call it. It was first of all published as a plan. They only published part of it. They had to be bullied into publishing the rest of it, but it's several documents around financial planning and staff planning and so on. When they then came to meetings to talk to us about it, they would say things like, well, it's not really a plan, it's a hypothesis. At one point it was a theory. They were kind of backing off being definite about what they were up to. Then it became, as we've heard, the STP partnership, no longer a plan, it's now a partnership. Then, more recently, several months ago, we heard about something called a memorandum of agreement, which was a completely new term. No one had the faintest idea what that was. And it turned out that NHS England had published this sort of framework for a memorandum of agreement. In the absence of being able to enforce accountable care systems on our local and national system, they were, as it were, establishing what they call a direction of travel. And the memorandum of understanding or agreement between the partners in Derbyshire around health and social care commits them to exactly what we've been hearing, operating at system level across the whole of the county, including the city, and that's a £2 billion health budget just for health. Never mind all the social care and all the other aspects of it, public health and so on. And they committed themselves, and they all have done this, they've signed the document, they commit themselves to operating in such a way that what they call suboptimal outcomes for one partner might be necessary in order for the whole system to work properly. Which is their way of saying, in my view, there could be a cut in services and budget for Dublin County Council, which is one of the partners, in order to save the bacon of some other part of the system, or vice versa, which is a highly risky proposition. which we did point out to them, and they poo-pooed and said, no, that's absolutely fine. We're only moving along this road. We haven't made any, signed any documents. There's no legal contract, blah, blah, blah. And then again, more recently, of course, we've heard of integrated care systems, which is, the way I look at it, it's like renaming Windscale Southfield, trying to forget the fact that it's radioactive. ACOs are radioactive, and if you call them integrated care systems, they're still radioactive. But this is the truth behind what they're doing, and that's why we've got this very important legal case going on. So in Derbyshire, what we've observed, and it makes me increasingly angry, really, is that, first of all, they were very secretive about the publishing the SDP. And the government, the excuse was, but the government told us we can't. Now, in Derbyshire, they took that literally and didn't publish anything that they said, except they did publish stuff a few months earlier, for some reason, for voluntary organisations, a version of it, which I found by Googling. No one's even heard of this document. And other parts of the country have made an effort to give some degree, or had made an effort to give some degree of sharing of this information. Derbyshire, they tried to keep a tight ship. And they then said, well, we're very, very sorry. The government told us to keep it all very secret. We're going to be very open now. It's all going to be on the website. You can come and look and so on and so forth. So if you do that now, documents are inevitable, I'm afraid. So, there's a website called Joined Up Care Derbyshire. So the SDP's name in Derbyshire is Joined Up Care. And in your part of the county, it used to be called Better Care Closer to Home. In my part of the county, down in Belper, it was called Joined Up Care. Joined Up Care became the title for the whole county's SDP plan. So if you go to this website, it tells you very soothingly about all the wonderful things that are happening under the SDP. One of the things it says is the SDP an organisation? Does it replace the current structure? No, it's not an organisation and will not replace the current structure. There's simply plans and frameworks. What do we find? There's an SDP board, which is a bureaucracy, and it has on it a guy called Chris Clayton, who is now the CEO of all four CCGs in Derbyshire, and he spends a lot of time toddling around going to CCG board meetings saying exactly the same things and sitting back and doing his job very nicely and being the head of everything and somehow running four CCGs where it used to take four people. All these meetings are held in secret. You can go to a CCG board meeting, you can go to the one in North Derbyshire or South Derbyshire or Erewash or Hardwick, you can listen to debates. You can ask questions and so on. You can put in FIs. SDP board, nothing. Nada. You don't hear anything about what they're talking about except what they choose to say at CCG or trust meeting. In their structure, which, as you expect, is quite complex, there's something called the Partnership Engagement Group, which is has such worthies as Health Watch Derbyshire. And representatives of apparently teachers and other professions, who knows how they were selected. The minutes and agendas of those meetings are published. That's a public engagement group. So this is pretty scary stuff, really. So if you want to find out what's really happening, you don't go to the Joined Up Care Derbyshire website. What you do, if you're a boring nerd like me, you look at the papers that are presented to the CCGs and you go to those meetings, as many of us have done. So, compared to this March edition of their newsletter, talks about, oh, well, we're working towards place-based care, and this is what they say about finance. Work continues on agreeing a single system, a system-wide savings plan by the end of April this year to help us make the significant savings that we must achieve. Conversations between commissioners and organisations which buy services and blah 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 are going on. It's all perfectly wonderful. If you go to what they're saying in the board meeting, the update says this. The transformation programmes outlined in the October 2016 SDP are not progressing at the pace we had planned. Many of the transformational programmes are not properly resourced to deliver. That means programme capacity, including analytics and finance. It is not, note the word not, it is not evident how specific pieces of work being undertaken by each SDP programme contribute to delivering the SDP model of CAP. That's three knots so far. The fourth knot, the SDP programmes and our financial turnaround are progressing in parallel and are not joined up. That's a very significant remark, because if you think about this, as I said, despite their claim there's not going to be a new structure, there is a new structure, the STP board and all sorts of stuff going on around transformation stuff. Meanwhile, the actual trust, the hospitals, the CCGs are carrying on with their normal business, trying to treat patients and do what they're paid to do. The result is, as it says here, not surprisingly, there remains a tension in terms of whether individuals prioritise their own organisation or the Derbyshire system. Blimey! So there is a sense that this is distracting us from implementing the joined up clinical and financial plan. So they're actually admitting this sort of nonsense crisis that they're facing. They're admitting it in their own paperwork, but not to the public facing. This is in the places where they don't expect people to turn up and they don't expect people to read. This is part of a document which has 250 pages. It's a monthly meeting. That's a standard size of documentation which they're nodding through. And when you say they, we're talking about GPs, we're talking about CCG managers, we're talking about Chris Clayton, the wonder boy who's floating around sorting all this out. And they're making these decisions and they're reporting back to the CCGs and the trust boards, and it's telling them what they're doing. Next paragraph. Bear in mind, this doesn't mention money at all, other than we need some. This says, in terms of our current financial position, the work to date by the system finance directors suggests that the Derbyshire gap will be 123 million. It was 64 million last time I saw them. That was about 3 months ago. Now they say 123 million, 80 million of which is an overcommitment of commissioning spend. What does that mean? People need treating, and they haven't got enough money to treat them in their budget, so they have to overspend their budget. What's the result? Commissioners are required by NHS England to identify how this cost will be removed from the system. And while this ask, in inverted commas, there's not the word ask, this is an ask, this is NHS England is asking them not to spend so much money. So it's directed at commissions. It is, however, a Derbyshire problem rather than a CCG only problem. Yes, it is. It's a Derbyshire. It's all of our problem, isn't it? Because it's not just the NHS that's being cut. And that's the other side of this, which pains me a great deal. But the fact that the Derbyshire County Council, which is in this part of the county, a social care provider, is effectively co-opted into this process in a number of ways. One, they signed up to the memorandum agreement. The other is that they have to meet targets for delayed transfer of care, i.e. bed blocking, for the newspaper report. So the hospitals are saying, well, we need social care to be available in the community so people can be go home and give us our bed back, right? So the government put pressure on local authorities. There's a massive row last year about this, about how unrealistic it was. Put pressure on local authorities to reduce delayed transport of care. Now, what we find, the theory, as we've been hearing, is that everything's going to be wonderful because care for you and your community, care at home, wraparound services, lots of people all flocking around making sure that you're being looked after. District nurses and so on. My father-in-law died around about Christmas time, and in North Yorkshire, in a small village. And if I counted, there was something of the order of 10 or 12, almost entirely, I think it was one man, coming from social care, NHS, some kind of voluntary organisation, all looking after and making sure of the way he died was dignified. And every single one of those people was furious about the system they were working in, the cuts, the pressure on them. It's nonsense about it all being wraparound care. However, what we have is that the Joy Hollister, a senior official at County Cork, is responsible for what they call PLACE, i.e. the place where your wraparound care is going to be organised. I don't know if any of you have come across this term at all. Do you know you live in a place in Derbyshire? There used to be 25 of them, and one of them was Belfast, where I live. However, that's no longer the case. There are now 8 places. And surprise, surprise, they are based on district boundaries, because then but enough resources have 21 places, obviously. So the place, which was going to be nice, intimate, the size of the town, everyone knows each other, they all work together, it's fine, has now expanded to the size of the district, which is a whole different thing, isn't it? However, Joy Hollister, our very senior official at the county, a lovely woman, I have to say, she is leading on the place-based work stream, what they call the work stream for place. And Dean Wallace, the head of public health at Derbyshire Council, is responsible for the figures, the dashboard you mentioned. So, in other words, how do you know an SDP is working? He's the guy who's supposed to come up with the figures. So, the County Council has been drawn into this deathly embrace of the SDP board and all that shenanigans, as has the City Council, of course. Which brings me really to how you sort of deal with all this stuff. And we try to attend meetings and listen and hear and ask questions. And one of the places we go is the Health and Wellbeing Board and the Health Scrutiny Committee, which are hosted by the County Council and by the City Council, the equivalent. There we have councillors who have very applied what they're talking about and haven't read the paperwork in my opinion. Because it's hugely complicated and they've got other things to do, apparently. So they just listen while the likes of the CCG or the SDP board members come along and line them with figures. And it's all fine, and it lasts about an hour, maybe, or less, and everyone goes home and they think they've done their job. Health scrutiny, they don't scrutinise anything. There's no such thing as scrutiny. It's not my idea of scrutiny. And unfortunately, we've got a Labour council in the city and a Conservative council in the county where councillors don't know what they're doing, really, what they're getting into. It is very complicated, and you do need to spend a lot of time trying to figure it out. And the officials, of course, are trying desperately to keep swimming, as hard as they can, as the waters rise, because it's their job. And it's the same job that the NHS staff have to try to make it work, even though if you get them on the QT, in the corridor, or outside the door, or in the back, they'll admit it's all going pear-shaped very rapidly. You know, what I said to you earlier, £123 million gap. And when you look, they said to us originally, we're going to cut beds. Beds are expensive. We're going to put the care in the community, we won't have a few beds, the cost will go down, and that's how we're going to save £280 million a year by 2021. So if you look at the analysis, they think they've saved about £1 million a year by Falsbury Hospital. New home alone, £1 million a year. Well, that's not even a dent in what they have to say. We've heard it very, very well put. They're not going to save the kind of money by the changes we're currently making. They've saved money so far largely by freezing salaries, and now they're not going to post. It's a 10% vacancy rate in NHS overall. I asked the SDP board what's the vacancy rate in Derbyshire, and I was told you have to talk to each member separately about that. We don't have those things, so they don't even know how bad the situation is on the staffing. And again, all of you know people who've been in the hospital or been treated or who have relatives who are working in NHS. They know what's going on. They're frightened, they're bullied into keeping quiet, and that is gradually falling apart. And there is, there's this awful disjuncture between what the local managers tell us, which is, we know we haven't got enough money, we're working as best we can, we are where we are, horrible, deathly brave. Meanwhile, the Commons Health Select Committee, the National Audit Office, the King's Fund, every reputable organisation you've ever heard of, the Royal College of Surgeons, the Royal College of Emergency Medicine, are saying at the tops of their voices, this system is radically short of money, it is in crisis.
Yeah.
But if they all know that, these are the, you know, the top experts who see the whole picture. Why can't this guy, Paul Wood, you know, the chair of Southern Derbyshire CCG, or Chris Clayton, the new guy, the head honcho across all the CCGs, why do they keep peddling this rubbish at us? You know, every time we talk to them, we quote the figures. There's not enough hospital beds. Why are you cutting hospital beds by a third in Derbyshire? The answer we got from Paul Wood, very senior doctor, as I say, the chair of the CCG in Southern Derbyshire, last time we discussed it, which was at the scrutiny, he was asked a direct question, which is very unusual, that a councillor actually put him on the spot about, well, what about this bed stuff? How can you cut a third of your beds? He said, yes, well, we did make some rather heroic idea, heroic projection. Lovely word, that. Heroic means that's not going to happen. It was stupid from the start. That was an admission right there, and we recorded the meeting, so it's not quite like that. And even if you go back to when NHS England, NHS Improvement, sorry, and NHS England together made an initial assessment of the plan in 2016, right back at the beginning, their letter says, we are nervous about your bed cuts, the scale of your bed cuts, which again is bureaucratic speech for, we don't believe you. So even NHS England staff who were peddling this stuff across all 44 HCG areas, they didn't believe it was possible. We're now hearing from places like Leicester, Sally Rowan, who talked to us in Derby recently, that Leicester's given up on their bed reduction programme. It's not possible. So they've been either lying or deluding themselves on the phone from the very beginning. This is what's so frustrating and infuriating for us about this. And why it's so important that more people like yourselves, if you don't already understand this, you know, we need to pay attention to what's happening. And 2 minutes. So the last bit, I'm just going to have a focus on privatisation. And again, the big denial. It's very interesting, even in documents produced by some Derbyshire CCG staff, they say things like, and of course, we have no intention to privatise. It's not part of the argument there. You know, they're talking about beds and they're talking about buildings, and suddenly there's this statement, oh, and by the way, we're not going to privatise anything. These campaigners, they're all, you know, like MPs, all these labels, having us, you know, scaremongering. It's not going to happen. We don't want to privatise. We're good people. So what do we find? I think I've done this before, but you know, Lancashire Health Child Programme, Healthy Child Programme, West Lancs Urgent Care and Community Care Programme, Essex County Council Children's Services, Luton's Community Musculoskeletal Service, Bath and North Somerset Social Care, Sexual Health Service in Middlesbrough, North Kent Community Services, Community Health Child Services, Wiltshire, Elder Care East Staffs, NHS and Social Care in Devon, Community Services in Surrey CCG. What's the common denominator? Virgin Care.
Yeah.
And that's all the last 2 years, by the way. So Virgin Care Services saw a 50% increase in revenues to 200 million in that period. And they took the commissioning agents in Surrey to court for 300,000 because they lost one of the contracts they went for. Okay, so these are not nice people. Now, they say that their Virgin Care business is a not-for-profit organisation and that they were invited in to help the NHS by Gordon Brown. So, you know, Richard and Gordon had a bit of chat, and Gordon said, come and help us run the NHS. Now, of course, now what they're doing, the latest idea is they've got a private NHS, sorry, private health arm, which charges treatment. That was formed in 2017. So having learned, as they are doing these private sector companies, all about the NHS through one means or another, they're now in a great position to use that knowledge to start charging services, which is what they are doing. And we have Virgin Care contracts in Lancashire, Yorkshire, Birmingham, Staffordshire, Warwickshire, not in Derbyshire yet. It's only a matter of time, isn't it? It's a tasty morsel, as I said. And final point, a lot of the expertise that they're getting is from the consultancy. Crapita, PricewaterhouseCoopers, Deloitte, McKinsey, and Derby, the SDP team in Derby, need help in order to create their training plans. So who do they pay it? And a company called General Electric Healthcare Finimal. General Electric is the fourth largest company in the world, and it didn't start off doing healthcare, did it? But it found a way of making money out of this kind of work. So they paid them $600,000 to help them create their plan. And Darvish GP Peter Holden, who many of you have heard of, who's been very exercised about all this, said that's £1,000 per GP in this county. Or as another GP said, how can we find cash for a cake when so many people have no bread? That's why we're coming to that.
Like to say that I'm sort of waiting for the day till we have a virgin birth centre, but I think we're